As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Go Lazio is brought to you by Bet365, the world's favorite online betting company. The Bet365 app lets you access pre-match and in-play markets and provides instant match updates across the biggest sports.
Today on Golazzo, another journey back in time to when Inter went Teutonic and supersonic with the Tre Tedeschi, Klinsy, Bremer and Mateus, the most successful hair transplant Milan has ever seen.
Golazzo!
Woohoo! Hello, calcistically minded listener. It's me, James Richardson. I'm joined, as ever, by James Horncastle. Ciao.
Ciao, ciao, Jimbo.
And also, very special guest today, Raphael Honigstein. Hi, Rafa.
Ciao, bello. Ciao, ciao.
Dear me. Rafa, I don't know if you've been, you know, following particularly our Golazzo series, but this is a little time we take to talk amongst ourselves about the good old days when Italian football was really, really special. And so were German footballers.
They were indeed, James. The golden days of the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, right. So these three Germans that we're going to talk about today, pretty diverse trio. That's diverse, not divers, although one of the cases. But still, three Germans who arrived.
Shaking his head.
Three Germans who made Inter winners against some of the most remarkable odds ever seen in football, I would say, arriving in a league which featured the three Dutchmen at Milan, Maradona at Napoli, so many stars, and turning into not just winners, but a record-breaking side. Rafa, were you following Inter once Mateus and Andy Bremer had gone across to Milan? Were you following? Were people in Germany following Inter Milan?
I was, and yes, they were. Inter became my Italian team for a short while because I was a huge fan of Lothar in particular. Really the player I think that everyone looked up to at the time in Germany because of his all-action persona. He was kind of a German Roy Keane, the way he played. He was just sensational. And yeah, Inter with the sexy shirts and these wonderful fans in the stadium felt very exotic, and it became, I'm sure, a well-supported team across Germany as a result. Mm.
A great kit, wasn't it? Classic.
Amazing.
Blue and black stripes with the Misura sponsor. To what extent was the arrival in 88 of Mateus and Bremer, with Klinsmann to follow a season later, to what extent was that Inter's response to the extraordinary Dutchman across town, James?
Well, I don't think they decided to go with Germans just because they had a track record of beating the Dutch at World Cup finals. They'd already gone German before, earlier in the decade, signing Hansi Müller and also Karl-Heinz Rummenigge.
Hansi Müller, it didn't work out too well, though. No sooner had he arrived than he released I don't know if you've ever heard the record that he made, Calcio di Rigore.
Calcio di Rigore.
Ma che bel portiere.
Parte una stangata, 1-0, hai vinto tu, bacio di rigore.
Bacio di rigore.
A German making a song about a penalty kick. I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, actually. But for that and other reasons, he was slapped in the face by Spillo Altobelli, and I don't think he ever really connected with the rest of the team. Pellegrini, who we'll come on to very, very shortly, moved him on soon after. But as you mentioned, Kalle Rummenigge coming in slightly later on, and not having perhaps the impact, but you tell the story of their predilection for Germans.
Well, so Inter had won the league title in 1980. And why this is important is because it was, I think, the last time that an all-Italian team had lifted the Scudetto. If you can lift a Scudetto, it's actually something you stitch on your shirt. And there was this sense that despite their name, Internazionale, a club that had been founded to basically, accept players of foreign descent to come and play for them, there was this feeling within the club that when they did sign foreign players, it tended to go wrong. And we've mentioned Hansi Müller. You alluded to Spillo Altobelli's slap, which he didn't take too kindly to Hansi not passing him the ball. Evaristo Beccalossi, who was the kind of number 10 of Inter at the time, didn't like basically the fact that the club signed him because Müller played in his position, and Beccalossi kind of called him the chair. He said he would rather play with a chair than Hansi Müller, because at least if you hit the ball at a chair, you might get it back, which is slightly bizarre. And then they signed Kalle Rummenigge, and Rummenigge, I think, was 30 or thereabouts, had won the Ballon d'Or in 1981, had been a part of that West Germany side that had got to the World Cup final in 82. His new teammate Beppe Bergami had marked him in that game, and there were great expectations that Rummenigge would be the guy who would come in and score as many goals as he had in Germany. I think he'd been top scorer three times in the Bundesliga, and he did okay, but injuries really kind of let him down. I mean, he scored some spectacular goals, James. I mean, we should recommend Golazzo listeners to go and check out just some of the bicycle kicks Rummenigge was responsible for in his days with the Nerazzurri. There's one against Torino, and there's one Zlatan-esque taekwondo kind of goal which was disallowed. A great injustice against Rangers, where he kind of lets it go over his shoulder and then does something that I've only seen in one of those kind of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon films. And it was disallowed for dangerous play and high boot. Crazy.
Mm. Rangers have got at the refs again, as was so often the case in their clashes with Italian sides. Anyway, he didn't actually win anything at Inter, although he did provide one or two golden memories. But the three Germans who arrived at the end of the 80s were to produce a paradigm shift in that club's fortunes. To tell their story, let's head back to a little bit earlier on in that decade, a simpler time.
We're living like in a Dolce Vita. Gonna dream tonight. We're dancing like in a Dolce Vita. Nobody else than you.
Rafa, do you remember Dolce Vita? We're living like in the Dolce Vita.
Yeah, absolutely. And Elf Freunde magazine did a magazine edition on Germans in the 80s in Serie A, because it was a bit of a time. And it was called Deutsche Vita, which I thought was very nice. And it had Hans-Peter Briegel on the cover in a little boat, I think, that he must have had when he was playing at Hellas.
Right. Thomasina Hessler? Was he in there?
Yeah, they were all in there, yeah.
Well, as I say, it was a simpler time, the 1980s. Time in Italy of economic boom, of huge optimism, of the revival of the Italian game and of Italian songwriting. Ryan Paris there, a fine example of that. Black Boxer just around the corner as well. But anyway, among those enjoying the boom times was one Ernesto Pellegrini, businessman and handwriting enthusiast who built a hospitality empire from scratch whose catering company used to do the honours at Villa Perosa, the Agnelli's summer residence. In 1984, Pellegrini bought Inter, leading to the immortal quote from Gianni Agnelli to Boniperti, "Have you seen, Giampiero? Our cook has bought Inter." Pellegrini didn't enjoy the joke and was determined to make them a force again. The first step was bringing in Trapattoni in 86.
Yeah, Trap and was seen quite ironically by Interisti, and including some of the players, like Walter Zenger, for example, who was like an Inter ultra, just wearing gloves, you know, just in the way that Buffon often has come across as being a bit of an ultra. Zenger certainly was in those days. He said, look, you know, of course, to get Inter to win again, it took someone who had made his name at Milan as a player and made his name as a coach with the Gobbi, the hunchbacks, over at Juventus. And yeah, Trapp had won everything. I mean, we've done a couple of shows on Trapp's coaching career, but there was nothing he hadn't done. You know, he'd won the Cup Winners' Cup, UEFA Cup, the European Cup, albeit with in the tragic backdrop of Heysel. Probably the strongest Juventus side that's ever been, with Platini, Boniek, and much of the players who won the World Cup with Italy in 1982. And I suppose as one of his pupils, back when he had another spell at Juventus, Antonio Conte, has kind of followed in the footsteps of Trapp in going from Juventus to Inter. And yeah, I think one of the fascinating things about Trapp's time at San Siro on the blue and black sponda, as they say, on the blue and black bank of the Naviglio River, is that he didn't win instantly. It took him some time. That's because Inter is a club like no other, in that he said it's like a centrifuga, you know, it's like a centrifuge, which just, it's like a whirlpool which just sucks so much stuff into it, which distractions, all these kind of news stories, which make it a really difficult team and club to manage. That unless you're a manager that has a really strong personality, who's able to get the team that you want, it's very difficult to do. And you know, that's why I think people, when they look back at Inter's history, you almost need to be a manager all'inglese, you know, sort of kind of English style coach who takes control of absolutely everything. You can't leave nothing to chance. And that was the case with Herrera, Mourinho and Trapp.
Trapp arrives in 86. As you say, success is not immediate. But in 1988, the club, perhaps slightly in response to the wave of sets of foreign players that had swept through Serie A, decide to head off to Bavaria and pick themselves up a couple of really choice foreign stars. In they go to Bayern Munich, and away they come with, arguably, Rafa, the heart of that side, the title-winning side from the Bundesliga. How were they able to do that?
Well, they were able to do that because at the time, Bayern Munich, even as the wealthiest club in Germany, could not compete with Inter's wages, let alone the transfer fees that they paid. In fact, the Rummenigge deal, I think, which cost 8.3 million marks at the time, a few years earlier, had effectively saved Bayern from bankruptcy. So it was a very, very important deal for Bayern that really helped them grow and gave them the funds that built that team that won three titles in a row that Lothar Matthäus led. So it was almost inevitable, I think, at the time that when you are approaching superstar status, you were going to Italy. It was the expected thing almost in Germany that, you know, these players, they're too good to stick around. And even Bayern couldn't keep them.
Pellegrini, I think, had made attempts to bring Matthäus in a couple of years before. Matthäus himself has also said that Maradona sent three or four people to his home in Munich with a suitcase full of money, 1 million marks. This is according to Lothar. He says, in 1987, Diego sent three or four people to my house in Munich with a briefcase full of cash, 1 million marks, and asked me to sign for Napoli. Interesting, interesting negotiating tactics in those
Very
days.
Very interesting.
It didn't work out.
It didn't work out. I wonder what happened to that suitcase.
Yeah, for real. But in 1988, he did make the move across. Now, for anyone who isn't familiar with Lothar Matthäus' career or whose view on it has perhaps been a little obscured by what happened after he retired, his attempts to become a manager, etc., let's just remind ourselves how great a player he was. One of the greatest midfielders of all time, no?
Without a doubt, James. I remember going to games in the Olympic Stadium where Mateus played three or four positions at the same time. You know, he was a deep midfielder, he was an 8, he was a 10. And I remember one particular game where he was basically in the opposition box all the time. I mean, unbelievable quality, force of personality, scored goals with his left foot on his right, even with headers, even though he wasn't the tallest of guys. And yeah, by far the most influential midfielders of the 80s in Germany. And a huge, huge loss for Bayern and for German football, and I mean domestic football. But almost inevitable, as we said earlier, that he was going to go to Serie A because he had reached superstar status. And the only place he could go from there was to go to Italy.
Mm. And he had possibly his greatest seasons ever while at San Siro. Coming with him, meantime, was the left-back Andreas Bremer, who people didn't know so much about. Gianni Mura, for example, writing in La Repubblica at the time, saying, "Se Mateus era la bistecca, Bremer era l'osso che andava presso la ciccia." If Mateus was the steak, Bremer was the bone that came with a bit of fat attached. Which, it's an interesting way of defining a player who himself was voted Serie A's Footballer of the Year. Tell us about Andy Bremer, Rafa.
Well, I think that that quote was something that probably, what's his name, Mura?
Yeah, Gianni Mura.
Gianni Mura came to regret, because Bremer was an unbelievable left back or wing back sometimes, you know, Germany playing often in a system with sweepers. So he was more than a defender. He was often a wide midfielder, effectively, and very famous for the distribution on his left foot. I read just a few moments ago before we started recording that he had 33 long passes in the final against Argentina, and every single one of them connected. So tremendously reliable, his distribution fantastic, great engine as well. And perhaps most famously, of course, he was almost completely ambidextrous, took free kicks with the right, took penalties with the right or the left. He himself didn't apparently know which foot was the stronger one. So if you had a wide player who was able to cut in on a foot that was just as good as the one he was playing on sidewise, made him a very, very special player. And I think his real quality was soon recognised in Inter and elsewhere.
Mm. Serie A Player of the Year for that season, that first season there, with the Nerazzurri, 88-89, where he formed Difesa di Ferro, an absolutely unbeatable defensive line with Walter Zenger in goal. You had Riccardo Ferri there. And
well, you said it was like an ironclad line. I mean, when you've got Ferri in there you go.
Nice. Nice, yeah. Well, with Bremer arriving, with the Mateus installed at the heart of everything, and with other acquisitions along the lines of Ramon Diaz and Nicola Berti, Inter were all set for what would turn out to be the season of records.
You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It's 1988. Busy time in Italy. Inter fan Vasco Rossi here with his ode to the dangerous life, Una vita spericolata, had just been done for huge amounts of cocaine. In football terms, the Dutch had just won the Euros. Milan had won the Italian title. Inter hadn't won anything in 8 years. But now Mateus and Bremer had arrived with a really, really strong lineup around them. Mentioned some of the players coming in. And the way that they began that season, James, was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, right from the get-go. They don't lose a game until, I think, February, at least in the league. Yeah, and yeah, this was pretty much unheard of in Italy. I mean, we've had teams that go on undefeated seasons before. I mean, before this, it was Perugia under, I think, the former Inter coach, Ilario Castagna, who was the guy who I think Trapp took over from at Inter. That team drew a lot of games. This team won a lot of games. I mean, in terms of points, I think they only dropped maybe 11 points all season, which is just ridiculous. I mean, part of the reason why it's 11 points is because it's still the 2 points for a win era in an 18-team league. And I do think this achievement of setting this record points total is not as talked about as much as it should be, at least outside of Italy. You know, when we tend to think of these great feats, it's usually Milan's Invincibles under Fabio Capello. And, you know, maybe because we've moved to a 20-team league with 3 points for a win, this kind of gets lost in the shuffle for a bit. But Inter were so dominant in what was, you know, we've always already mentioned how competitive the league was, but given the standing that Milan team has in the game as being, you know, one of the three teams the last 50 years to push football forward with Rinus Michels' Ajax and more recently Pep's Barcelona, to knock them off their perch, James, was quite something.
Certainly was. First 16 games of the season, as you say, they did not lose. They only conceded 5 goals in those 16 matches. They didn't lose until February the 12th in Florence, when they came out the wrong end of a seesaw 7-goal thriller with Fiorentina. 4-3 it ended. Napoli, who were their biggest rivals, had a slight glimmer of hope perhaps after that result, but Inter responded by winning their next 8 Serie A games, including a 6-0 thrashing of Bologna. And by the end of May, even though there were 4 games to go, it was already match point to the Nerazzurri. They needed one more win. They were about to face their rivals Napoli with Maradona and Careca at San Siro on the 28th of May, 1989. Milan had just won the European Cup 4 days before. Careca actually opened up the scoring for the Neapolitan visitors at San Siro on that Sunday afternoon. But it wasn't long before Nicola Berti, who'd knocked one off Luca Fusi to equalise. And then, who else should score the winner but Lothar Matthäus? And Inter were champions. Margin of victory, 11 points, a record, as you say, for an 18-team, 2 points for a win season. 58 points, their total, also a record. 26 wins in that time, only 2 defeats, 67 goals scored, only 19 conceded. Remarkable stuff. One of the few defeats they'd had along the way was when they took on Bayern Munich in the UEFA Cup. Rafa, that must have been sweet for Bayern, having just lost 2 of their stars.
It was. I mean, it was a classic tie. A very young Bayern team, which had the likes of Olaf Thon playing midfield, were beaten 2-0 in Munich and basically thought they were out. This was a time when if you didn't win your home game, you were basically considered to be already eliminated. And I remember so well the return leg, because it wasn't on German television, it wasn't live. So you had to listen on the radio and then you could see only highlights at 11 o'clock. And it turned into one of the all-time great Bayern Munich performances in European competition. When they beat Inter 3-1 in San Siro, they took a 3-0 lead and then held out, even though they conceded one more goal. And Raimund Aumann, who was by then in goal for Jean-Marie Pfaff, who'd moved on, had his best and most heroic and legendary night for Bayern in goal, because Matthäus in particular created a lot of chances. And Aumann was just superb.
Palla che si impenna. Ancora un colpo di testa da parte di Coso, poi una parata miracolosa di Aumann.
Nobody really talks about that game in Italy. They talk a lot about the first leg.
Yeah.
And Nicola Berti's extraordinary run, where he does a sort of a George Ware, a Maradona, if you want, runs pretty much the length of the field in the snow of Munich, and then finishes. I mean, it's his most famous goal, James, the one that has become iconic there.
Contropiede ancora, Berti! 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 Tiro! E gol! Straordinario gol di Berti! Eccezionale!
Riccardo Ferri saying afterwards that it became a real issue because having scored that once, bet he tried to do that every time he got hold of the ball in midfield.
I was at the game in Munich.
You were?
Mm.
So you saw Bertie's goal?
Yeah, I can't say I remember it that well. I think my mind is blanked out that defeat, but I would have been in the stadium.
All right, then. Well, the European misadventures aside, it was an extraordinary performance in league terms. Why was it, though, so short-lived, James?
Well, you've talked to some of the players, the Italian players. I think that the club moved some of the guys on too early. And this is quite interesting because this whole podcast is about the three Germans. I know Riccardo Ferri thinks that they shouldn't have sold Ramon Diaz as quickly as they did. And, you know, it would have been better to keep him as part of the side instead of bringing in Klinsmann. And that's not to say that Klinsmann was a bad player or an ineffective player for Inter. They just felt that what they had going on in 88-89 was so damn good. And I suppose then you have the competitiveness of the league, because it's not just the teams that we've mentioned. In 1990, be the kind of swan song of Maradona's Napoli. And then you have this kind of very young Sampdoria side, just mature after kind of playing together for 8 years or so and winning more or less everything else. You know, the Coppa Italia, reached finals in Europe, Cup Winners' Cup. So I think it was just a measure of how strong the league was in those days. The other thing, I suppose, which is really kind of dumbfounding about this Inter team is just how poor they were in Europe. You know, I think this is often the case in a kind of pre-Champions League, pre-group stage tournament, where the potential for shocks was so much more. You know, they go out to Roy Hodgson's Malmo as champions in one of the kind of most infamous nights in Inter's history, along with when they lost to Helsingborg. I mean, there are a few in recent history. I think was it drawing or losing to Hapoel Belsheva? I can't even remember what that team is called. But yeah, it is surprising that even when they kept the Germans together for another couple of years and added Klinsmann, the only kind of trophy that they added was the UEFA Cup in 91. So it's I think it's a measure of just how good the league was at the time.
89-90, they finished up third, as you say, knocked out right at the start of their European Cup campaign by Malmo. That season, though, was to end with some extraordinary success for the three Germans in Italy, although not for Inter.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Notti magiche. James Horcastle joining Gianna Nannini and Eduardo Benato, therefore, on Estate Italiana. Very much the theme in Italy of Italian 90. that most cherished of World Cups. It was in Italy.
It was actually a terrible World Cup.
Well, was it though?
Football-wise.
West Germany didn't have a bad World Cup at all. And although the final against Argentina with Andy Bremer spraying those deep passes and also scoring the World Cup winning goal in it, it wasn't the best of matches with which to conclude the tournament. West Germany's opening to their campaign was one of the big highlights, no? Rafa, were you at that game as well?
I wasn't, no, James. I didn't go to the World Cup. I would have been a little bit too young. But I remember Bild's headline after that 4-1 win against Yugoslavia. It said, "Danke, Franz, für diese Liebesnacht," which translates at "Thank you, Franz," in relation to Franz Beckenbauer, "for this night of love."
Well, there you go.
Ooh.
It was a pretty special game. 4-1 against not just any side, but Yugoslavia, who probably came in as, I don't know what the odds were in those days, but
I would hazard a guess that Jonathan Wilson had them down as the dark horses for that tournament.
Right, well, there you go. That was until they met Lothar Matthäus and co. Matthäus in particular had an absolute blinder. You talk about him playing four or five different positions. And this game, a great example of that, shutting down Stojkovic, but at the same time managing to score a brace. Klinsmann scores as well. And West Germany got off to an extraordinary start to the season. When you look at that campaign, possibly helped by the fact that three of the stars were already playing their football in Italy. Were they kind of the key? Were they at the heart of that West Germany World Cup winning tournament?
Yeah, absolutely. Together with Rudi Völler up front and Jürgen Kohler at the back, that was the spine. But it was a team and a dressing room full of big players. I think that was the secret to this team. They had all won things at club level. They were all big personalities. And Beckenbauer, having been slightly less patient in previous tournaments, I think had found a slightly more relaxed way of dealing with them. And they had a lot of time off, for example, and they would go, you know, for a trip to Milan, or they would go and just have a time off. And they seemed to enjoy being with each other and being in Italy. And yeah, they had a very good team. And of course, they fulfilled their potential.
Matthäus does the reverse Maradona in that, you know, Maradona won the World Cup in 86, and that kind of gave the Napoli players the belief that it was going to be their year the following year in 87. Whereas, obviously, Matthäus wins it at the league in 89, and peaks, I would say, in 1990. Also because even in this season of, in his, what would be his third season, so 1990 to 91, at Inter, that's probably his best season from a statistical point of view. He scores 23 goals in all competitions, which for someone in Italy playing in his position in midfield is pretty much unheard of.
The funny thing was that in Germany at the time, before this tournament in Italy, Matthäus was still being seen as somebody who doesn't quite do it at the highest level. He'd had a very poor European Cup final in 1987 against Porto, which Bayern lost. Bayern hadn't won an international trophy. Germany hadn't won an international trophy. So for all the dominance that he was able to show regularly at club level, that big trophy was still eluding him. And in Germany, people were still having sort of casting aspersions at him. And it all changed, of course, in the course of those few weeks in Italy in that summer.
I mean, James, to go back to your question about, you know, why wasn't this Inter team able to repeat in the league, you know, towards the end of Matthäus's time at San Siro, you know, he was going back and forth between Milan and Switzerland to see his girlfriend, Lolita Morena. And Trapp apparently could see that it was affecting his performances, and, you know, would go into the car park at Appiano Gentile, where Inter's training ground is, and kind of check the mileage on his car to see if he'd been sort of he'd been traveling a lot. But Matthäus had so many cars, apparently he just kept turning up in different ones, or was using another vehicle to go to Switzerland. So that's kind of one of the other reasons why that incredible Inter side maybe didn't hit the same heights.
It was busy hitting other things, yes, in a variety of motor vehicles. Now, on the subject, though, so Matthias had an extraordinary World Cup and consecrated his status in the world game. Klinsmann, what was it, 3 goals in that tournament, and that was a feat he would repeat at later World Cups as well. But Andy Bremer, given his extraordinary numbers and the way he influenced, you mentioned his passing stats in the final, he scores the winner. He scored 3 goals, which is not bad for a left back in a World Cup, in a particularly low scoring World Cup as well. He scored against Holland in the quarterfinals, scored, of course, the free kick that deflects off Paul Parker against England in the semi-final, and then the winning penalty against Argentina. Why does he not enjoy, and possibly he does in Germany, but why elsewhere do you think he's gone a little bit forgotten among the pantheon of greats?
I don't know about forgotten. I mean, people do remember him as an integral part of that World Cup winning squad, but I mean, fullbacks or wingbacks don't quite have the same stature. They don't quite have the same glamour attached to them. I mean, if you think of Philipp Lahm, who, if anything, surpassed Bremer, I think in 10 years' time, you know, people in Germany will appreciate him, but he will probably not be the first name that people will mention when it comes to, you know, great players of the century or of the decade. So I think there's something in the position that your very dependability and the fact that you are playing without flaws rather than with big moments that stick in the memory, stick in the mind, makes those kind of players just slightly less memorable. It's just a function of their game, I think.
Mm. Although, you know, scoring the goal which wins the World Cup final is
that
pretty big
is
moment.
Still, yeah, continues. And there's a whole story around this, but I don't know if you want to talk about this now.
Well, go ahead.
So Matthäus was due to take the penalty, famously, but he had broken a stud in his shoe and had changed his boots and just didn't feel entirely happy with his new boots, and then left it to Andreas Bremer, who was so secure and confident. And there's two parts of the stories. One is that people in Germany, I think, have kind of later on looked at this and think, was this really smart for Matthäus? Was this sort of the sign of a mature leader to know your own insecurities effectively and make way for somebody that you trust more? Or was this another occasion where he seemed to kind of disappear from the biggest stage when it really mattered? That was an accusation leveled at him in the wake of the 1999 final that Bayern had lost against Manchester United, where he gets substituted 5 minutes from the end, and Mehmet Scholl said, oh, Matthäus always goes missing when it really comes down to it. So there's all of that mixed up in it. But at the same time, I thought it was it's quite funny, because as if the pressure wasn't big enough on Andreas Bremer, Rudi Völler steps up to him and says, remember, Andy, if you score, we win the World Cup. Which, you know, didn't prove detrimental, but perhaps could have gone the other way.
Remarkable. Well, at the end of that year, Andy Bremer places third in the Ballon d'Or voting, but it's won by Lothar Matthäus, who remains the only player ever to win the Ballon d'Or while playing his football for Inter. Anyway, what came next? We'll talk about that after this.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. Campionato di
calcio italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
So, 1990-91, Matthäus has his best season ever, statistically guiding Inter to a long-awaited European success in the UEFA Cup over Roma. Klinsmann doesn't have a good time at all. He doesn't actually score a goal until December and wants to quit the team, supposedly over his differences of opinion with Trapattoni. As it turns out, Inter themselves will make changes at the end of the year. Trapattoni moves on and the players take their leave of Italy as well. Andy Bremer goes to Real Saragossa. Mateus returns to Bayern Munich and perhaps influenced by his 4 years in Italy becomes a libero. As for Klinsmann, he goes to loads of places. Monaco, Tottenham, Bayern again, Sampdoria, Tottenham once more. Orange County Blue Stars as well under an assumed name in the early noughties.
Jay Goppingen.
That's the one.
And of course, James, you mentioned, you know, was signing the three Germans or staggering those three Germans a response to Milan's Dutchman. Well, I don't think it was, but you know what you see post-Trapattoni when they appoint Corrado Orrico, sort of a guy who I suppose you can compare with Sacchi insofar that this guy had only once coached in a long coaching career in Serie A and had been sacked like halfway through a season with Udinese, but played zone and also like had all these kind of really innovative ideas like we're going to train in a cage. And then they signed what? Dennis Bergkamp and Wim Jonk under Bagnoli. And neither of them, particularly Bergkamp, they really struggle. Whereas I suppose, you know, Hullit, Van Basten, Rijkaard, they kind of, for at least a 1 or 2 more years, are still very much on top in Serie A, very much symbolic of that Milan team as that kept on winning under Fabio Capello.
Mm. Although they got rid of their Dutchman as well. It's curious how that period when all the clubs wanted to have either three players from a certain nation or at least with some kind of vague genetic similarity, at least, you know.
Well, I'd never looked at Juventus post-Platini as the Juventus of the Sovietici, the Soviets of Juventus, you know, with Zavarov and Alenichev or is it Alenikov? Can't remember. I always get them mixed up. But that you had to have a block of players from a one particular country or federation in that case.
Yeah, or in the case of Napoli, a kind of a South American flair trio with Careca and Maradona and sort of Alamal, though he doesn't really fit into that category quite so much. They did try with other Germans, Rafa, post the departure of Klinsmann, Bremer and Mateus. Mateus Sammer was there for all of 11 games. This was pre him winning the Ballon d'Or. And also Lukas Podolski, who pitched up much, much later on loan from Arsenal, managed a whopping 17 matches for Nerazzurri. Any others that I'm missing out on?
No, that's it. That's, yeah. So, Poldi was the first one after Sammer. So, yeah, there's not been any others.
All right. Well, when you've had the best, hard really to make do with anybody else. Are Inter still popular with you, Rafa, and with German football fans?
Well, I personally still have a soft spot for them. I don't know if I can speak for the rest of Germany, but I think I would say historically they would have some support, but perhaps not quite as much as Juve, who I think are probably the number one team outside Italy as far as Italian and non-Italian support is concerned.
And when you rank them against whether it's other trios from other countries or just generally the imports, which started to flood Serie A after the late 80s, how would you rank that set of acquisitions, James?
Oh, I think right up there at the top. I mean, I always find it interesting at the moment, the last couple of years, really, Beppe Bergomi, who is the captain of that team, you know, has always been asked, you know, what do Inter need? What are they missing to win the title again under Conte or even before that under Spalletti? And he always mentions a kind of Mateus-style figure. And he's not just talking about the guy that Mateus was on the pitch in terms of this box-to-box player, but someone that you could look across at in the tunnel and find reassurance. You know, Lothar was, it was always going to be okay as long as he was on the pitch. He was confident that they were going to win, so they should be confident that they were going to win. And having personalities like that. So I do think in Italy, it seems like certainly more so than in other countries, they have the cult of the campione. You know, you have to have a champion on your team. And I would say Mateus is very symbolic of that, at least at Inter, as being, I mean, if we're talking about a team that is called Internazionale, that, you know, became, what, over the last decade, you know, the first team to kind of field an all-foreign 11, has had plenty of incredible foreign players. I think, you know, Mateus is in terms of Inter's pantheon of all-time greats, is definitely in there. No, I mean, certainly had a more decisive impact on the team than, say, even the original or phenomenal Ronaldo, who didn't win the league, who wasn't able to get them past a Berlusconi's Milan or a Lippi's Juventus. So
Modric's Juventus.
I think in that respect, right up there, James, right up there.
Right. And the success may not have lasted, but it was perhaps the most impressive of all, given, as we mentioned before, the league that it came against, the league of Maradona, of Hullet, and so many other stars. Alrighty. Wow. Many thanks, Rafa, for joining us then for this special look back at the Tre Tedeschi. I crocchi.
Grazie a voi.
Prego, prego, Rafa. And many thanks as well to James Horncastle. We'll return with another Golazzo soon. If you've got anything you'd like us to talk about, why not get in touch? For now, though, as we sign off with Interista Doc Vasco Rossi with Va Bene Così, from all of us here, it's arrivederci.
You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. Check out all of The Athletic's podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.